Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Hey, folks. So many links between liver and brain. Today's guest on the SBGAN podcast is Professor Dr. Valerie McLean, a Scots Bruxelloise, living and working in Geneva, where she has, in spite of considerable social pressure, retained that pronunciation of her surname. There at the University Hospital, she heads the Department of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, and she has pursued a particular interest, that of blood flow through the liver and the effects that disorders of hepatic perfusion have on both intellection and the physiology of intellection, cerebration. Manifest dysfunction of cerebration and thus of intellection resulting from liver disease is termed hepatic encephalopathy. It can occur with or without primarily disordered intermediary metabolism. Congenital portosystemic shunts underlie some instances of hepatic encephalopathy without primary hepatocellular metabolic dysfunction. Portosystemic shunting that results from vascular malformation rather than from hepatic scarring may, of course, secondarily perturb intermediary metabolism. Dr. McLean has substantially contributed to recognition that there is a spectrum of, now follow the initial letters here, neurocognitive dysfunction in children with chronic liver disease or portosystemic shunting. And if you do the right sort of berry picking among the initial letters there, you come up with the abbreviation SLIPS, S-L-I-P-S, for that dysfunction. Hepatic encephalopathy in children, unlike in adults, may alter brain development as well as brain function. In consequence, successful palliation of liver disease in children, as with liver transplantation, may not entirely ameliorate cognitive deficits such as impaired attention, impaired executive function, slowed processing, and school performance. Structured neuropsychological assessment and interventional support thus are important for children living with liver disease in all phases of their journey. Dr. McLean today offers three articles. Bibliographic details are available in the online précis of this session as a basis for discussion. They are titled Minimal Hepatic Encephalopathy in Children with Chronic Liver Disease, Prevalence, Pathogenesis, and Magnetic Resonance-Based Diagnosis, The Current Pediatric Perspective on Type B and C Hepatic Encephalopathy. I point out that the senior author on this one, which must mean it's particularly good, is Dr. McLean herself, and Neurometabolism and Brain Morphometry in an Adolescent Female with an Extrahepatic Congenital Portosystemic Shunt. Today, she'll give us her perspectives on SLIPS, with her proposals for a diagnosis of what can be subtle, easy-to-miss problems, and suggestions on patient management. It's nice to have you here.
It's great to be here, Alex. Thank you.
Let's start with the basics. What are the features of neurocognitive involvement in children with chronic liver disease or portosystemic shunting?
Where to start?
That's your business.
I think this is why, together with a group of colleagues within SBGAN, we found this acronym SLIPS, because we wanted to convey the sense of spectrum. It really varies from patient to patient. My hypothesis, or our hypothesis, I should say, is that since children are affected with their liver disease at different times in their development, the repercussions of liver disease on the brain are going to vary according to the underlying neurodevelopmental, neurocellular processes happening at that given time point. So to answer your question, the clinical presentation can vary from... there's two points at which you can assess the consequences. One is at the time of the liver disease, and then the other is later in life. At the time of liver disease, you might see in the typical little pediatric patient with biliary atresia, you may just see fine motor and gross motor changes that are ascribable to prolonged hospitalization and whatnot. But then later on in life, after transplant, these are patients where the parents are going to tell you, he's really distracted in class and he's having trouble. In the first primary years, he might be fine. But then in the latter years, as tasks get more complex, that's when the executive functioning challenges emerge. An important way to catch that in history would be to ask the family, what class is the child in? Because you might find also that there's, in addition to executive functioning issues, there might be delay. And parents will say, oh no, he's doing fine in school, but when in fact he's 2 years behind. Just because they're so happy he's alive and because he is doing fine in the appropriate class, but he might be in a special class or he might be have been held back a couple years. So to answer your question, the manifestations can be motor, can be developmental delay, can be speech delay, executive functioning issues in the spectrum of ADHD. The team at King's has a study looking also at autism spectrum disorder in these children. Is that one of the manifestations? People have reported seizures, although I suspect that's quite rare. So the spectrum is very, very broad, which is one of the reasons that our group thought that the term hepatic encephalopathy may not be appropriate in pediatrics for children with chronic diseases and chronic portosystemic shunting, which is, of course, very different from the acute liver failure consequences.
I wonder if to ask you about how patients are referred to you or to your team might throw some light on manifestations and presentations.
So thank you for the question. Patients are referred for liver disease. Patients are not referred for neurocognitive issues. Patients, you and I have had the chance to talk about congenital portosystemic shunts. Mm-hmm. Among those patients that are referred for congenital portosystemic shunts, there are patients with neurodevelopmental delay or behavioral issues or a phenotype resembling attention deficit disorder. But that's usually, it's not the sole presentation. It's part of a package.
Mm-hmm. A child happens to have liver disease or to have had liver disease, and now a few years later in school is a dreamer, needs to be recalled to class from time to time. There were a lot of class sessions in which I was dreaming, I wasn't paying attention. When does, if I suppose that with any child who has had liver disease, that you could make a good argument for maybe this should be neuropsychiatrically evaluated in a systemic manner, that this should be examined from the point of is SLIPS present? But we'd be the poorer without dreamers. What's the threshold?
Excellent question, to which I don't have a good answer. Yes, there are many dreamers. I think ideally, those children, if the parents, if we take a good history when they come back for annual follow-ups, if it transpires that they're having challenges in school, trying to get appropriate neurocognitive evaluation would be great. In practice, it's difficult because, as you know, neuropsychologists are highly specialized and few and far between. But I think that would be the most appropriate thing at that point in time to see if they could benefit from school support or medication support.
Does your team in Geneva include such professionals?
We do have a team like that. Of course, as you know, Switzerland has the linguistic challenges, so we have to refer to local resources. But in French in Geneva, yes, we do have the team. But it doesn't mean we don't have to wait 6 to 12 months for an eval, but we do.
I'm trying to think back to when I was eavesdropping on people speaking Swiss German, couldn't understand a word. Talk about linguistic challenges. Anyhow, Sorry, that was certainly a digression. So, tips, tricks, and challenges in diagnosing SLIPS. Start at the beginning, go to the end, and then stop.
I'll start with tips. Suspect it.
Tips, suspect it. Be on the qui vive. Okay.
And suspect that your little infant in whom you don't see it may develop it later. So keep it as a part of the history as you follow these kids longitudinally.
How do you avoid setting up a trigger for the parents? In that, oh my gosh, our child is a dreamer. His brain isn't working.
Great question. We reassure them that they will go to school and they will have a job. This is why we take care of their kids, but that they should not hesitate to let us know if they realize there's things at school, because then we can help. So I think by being reassuring, really.
Indeed. Okay. Once you make it, I'm so used, even after 20 years here, 25 years here, I'm still so used to thinking along the lines of USA healthcare, in which to have a problem is to be left alone with it and not to be able to pay for making it better. But one of the reasons I chose to stay is that Europe is a kinder place, and that those kindnesses extended to members of the community who need extra help is a wonderful thing. Challenges.
Resources. So the challenges are, like you highlighted, diagnostic. So finding available experts who know how to diagnose these kids. That's one challenge. The other challenge is the longitudinal follow-up. So studies are a challenge because you're going to need a series of tests in one age group and another series of tests in the other age group and so on and so forth all the way into adulthood. So following these data longitudinally is challenging either for a given patient or for a study.
Following them into adulthood, here we have the question again of transition from pediatric to adult care, and the sensation that at the end of 18 years, you have to have adequate speed to lift your wheels from the runway. How do you handle those sorts of transition, transition in your patients?
Great question. I think a lot of the children, either for emotional or neurocognitive reasons, need support beyond 18 years. And while even a few years ago, the sort of practice was to say once you pass 18 or 20 and you transition to the adult clinic, you need to be on your own and your parents will stay out of the room. I think that has changed, and our adult colleagues see the family as a support system. And and include them more and realize that the family has a lot to offer because the adult physicians don't have the time. One of the reasons is they don't have the time. So probably the parents continue to carry some of the burden of maybe the organizational skills or the executive functioning challenges that the young person might have.
I have to confess that I know people who took their laundry home, even several years into their third decade. Support systems from parents are very important. Have we touched on tricks in diagnosing SLIPS? We've done the tips, we've done the challenges. Let's do the tricks.
The tricks, I think, are to be pragmatic. So we can't diagnose all these kids. I think based on the first study you cited that I sent, the beautiful study out of India, it's quite clear that even those patients who did not meet the criteria that they had established in their study for what they call minimal encephalopathy did score lower across all domains than the patients who, the healthy controls. So there are subclinical manifestations. So it's sort of a case of guilty until proven innocent, which I know is a big no-no, but where supporting kids and families as early as they're willing is probably in the best interest of the child, just with simple things, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and increasing awareness. That would be my tip at this point, because I think we have reached a time, if we take the example of patients who undergo liver transplantation, we've reached a time where we assume that we can assume safely that survival is the norm in most cases and prolongation of relatively normal life expectancy. And so now we can focus on these issues, these neurocognitive issues, which have been described for a long time, but we don't necessarily have a clear phenotype, a clear way to diagnose. So we can be very pragmatic and say, it can't hurt to give them extra little tools to get over some of the hurdles.
But perhaps a follow-up question to that would be getting them over the hurdles. And getting them over the hurdles could, at a stretch, be extended to include liver transplantation.
Correct.
So I want to ask you, as your team size up patients for possible transplantation, how, if at all, do you weight evidence of neurocognitive involvement?
Another important question in the community right now is how do we weigh that into our liver transplant decisions? It's very center dependent. My impression from talking to colleagues, because of course this has not been analyzed in a methodical fashion or reported, is that it weighs in if there's at least one other indication, but in and of itself,
it doesn't bump you up the transplant list.
I recently had a patient where this whole debate came up, but ultimately when I saw her in clinic, the risks of transplant outweighed the benefits for a little girl who, like you say, is a dreamer.
Let her dream for a little while longer, and there's time enough in adulthood to wake up. Eh? Well, I want to ask your opinion about the case report. The case report from JPGN. Neurometabolism and brain morphometry in an adolescent female with an extrahepatic congenital portosystemic shunt. I liked reading that, although I probably didn't get as much out of it as I should have done. But what would you recommend that we take away from reading that paper?
I think the message is that in addition to altering neurometabolism, liver disease and portosystemic shunting may impact brain growth. We have yet to image her following transplantation, but we did do it in another little patient who underwent liver transplantation for biliary atresia, and were able to show that she recovered brain volume following liver transplantation. Now, granted, these are anecdotal reports, but brain atrophy has been shown in other conditions. But I would argue that this is not brain atrophy. This is brain underdevelopment, because the congenital portosystemic shunt in the case of this young patient was, as its name suggests, congenital, and therefore interfered at times of development where there's major cell growth and proliferation. The baby's brain is 400 grams and it's 1 kilo at 2 years. So imagine if you have substances crossing the blood-brain barrier during those 2 years that hinder cell development, differentiation, and synaptogenesis. One of the consequences can impact brain volume.
Not brain atrophy, because nothing was lost. It simply wasn't laid down. Simply wasn't laid down appropriately.
That's my vision, yeah.
Okay. What other aspects of these disorders would you like to touch on for us all?
I think an important aspect to touch on is that we don't have a good biological way of screening. In the adult world, ammonia is seen as the biomarker.
That's the proxy that I grew up learning about.
Yeah, the fasting biomarker. And it's still very much used in adult encephalopathy.
Okay.
in children, because their overall, well, we don't know why, but probably because their overall muscle mass is less than in an adult patient, it's not a very good marker because it may be normal. So, for example, if I take the patients with congenital portosystemic shunts, they may have a normal fasting ammonia. But if you look at the ammonia dynamically after a protein load, after a meal, it may spike to 120 or 200, which obviously meets encephalopathy, even acute encephalopathy criteria. So I think that a normal ammonia does not rule out impaired, does not rule out SLIPs, if we want to use today's acronym.
Well, that's a diagnostic hint as well, isn't it? Yeah. If consider a protein load if you want to really find out.
That is something that I think is worth exploring. I know there's some centers looking at EEGs, and I think that data is forthcoming. I haven't seen it yet, but I look forward to reading it. So yes, I think we might have tools where we can provoke or measure more accurately than just by taking a history or little neurocognitive tests. I think another, there's two other molecules that are worth discussing. The role of hypoglycemia might contribute. Patients with liver disease, especially advanced liver disease in childhood, have repetitive bouts of hypoglycemia. Certainly, the patients with congenital portosystemic shunts have hyperinsulinemic hypoglycemia, especially in the early years. And so it's a situation of multiple hits. And so if you have circulating metabolites, including elevated postprandial ammonia and preprandial hypoglycemia, it's one hit plus another on a developing brain. And then finally, I think hopefully in the next decade or so, we'll learn more about the role of bile acid signaling in
You're just saying that to please me. Bile acid signaling?
I owe that to a lot of mentors. If you want to be one of them, that's fine.
No, I'm not. I have no ambitions to mentor status, but the idea that bile acids are at the heart of it all definitely suits me. We're running out of time. Certainly not out of things to talk about. But I'd like to ask you if you're ready to contribute to the Espigan Favorite Songs playlist on Spotify, a song that means something to you or that you particularly enjoy.
Certainly. And before I tell you about the song, I'd just like to draw the audience's attention to an ASLD webinar that will be held next September 22nd, 2026 on the theme of SLIPs. And there will also be some basic science data from my wonderful colleague in Texas, Sharon DeMauro. So now about the song, yes, I'm going to share Mon Petit Gars by Drôle de Dame, which is a very heartwarming and uplifting story about the superpowers of kids with ADHD.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.